You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Well, greetings again. This is Bob Mallon with Military News. And let's get started. Thank you for joining me. First article from military.com is entitled, Pentagon complied with COVID-19 waiver rules, according to Watchdog, but services moved slowly. This was published military.com by Konstantinian Toropin, published March 15, 2024. A Pentagon watchdog review of the military COVID-19 vaccine of the exemption process found that each of the branches largely complied with policies and in some cases even went beyond what was required to consider service members' requests for religious accommodation. While rejecting a number of accusations that the service hadn't properly reviewed waiver requests, the Pentagon's Inspector General did fault the Army and Air Force for taking too long to process the requests and wrote in a report released Thursday that discharges were inconsistent, leaving some service members with full benefits while others were left with partial benefits. The exemption process became the subject of political and legal scrutiny amid the height of the pandemic, after some service members filed legal challenges that ultimately made their way to the U.S. Supreme Court. The investigation was kicked off in February 2022, after the Inspector General, quote, received complaints through the DOD hotline between August 2021 and June 2022, alleging that military services were improperly processing COVID-19 vaccination examination requests for exemption, end quote. The report said, we continued to receive complaints and, on June 2, 2022, the acting DOD Inspector General issued a memorandum to the Secretary of Defense. The memo told Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin that the watchdog found a trend of generalized assessments and denial memorandums were reviewed generally. They did not reflect an individual analysis. It was an allegation that was key to the arguments of several court cases filed by service members that were largely successful in halting discharges over a refusal to comply with the policy. However, the Inspector General ultimately found no evidence that the services were rubber-stamping denials, declaring that investigators found no evidence of a lack of individual review by the decision authorities. Investigators said that officials that they interviewed discussed the cases in detail, but they created approval and denial letter templates to both streamline the process and make sure all the request information were being conveyed to service members. The allegations of rubber stamping even made it to at least one of the offices and prompted discussions among staffers about whether the wording should be altered. Ultimately, the unnamed office kept the templates out of a desire to provide consistency for the denial and out of a fear that more customized letters would suggest service members were all being reviewed under the same standards. The report also noted at one point that some requests were considered by the services, even though they didn't need to be. The report cited four requests by Army soldiers whose chaplains determined that the four service members did not have sincerely held religious beliefs to support a religious accommodation as required by DOD policy. In each case, the Army Decision Authority stated that they considered the service members' requests regardless of the chaplain's assessment, the report said. The Army and Air Force delays in meeting their 90 and 30-day processing deadlines, respectively, were chalked up to the large volume of requests, more than 16,000 as of January 2023. Out of the requests reviewed by Inspector General, the Army's cases averaged 192 days to receive a decision, while the Air Force requests averaged 168 days. Staffers in the offices that typically handle exemption requests told investigators that they normally handed just a few requests a year and on simpler topics such as grooming or clothing, not something as complex as vaccinations. Investigators also faulted the services for discharging service members under varying discharge types of reentry codes, while the report explained that this occurred because the DOD did not have department's legal guidance requiring uniformity. They nevertheless pointed out that service members experienced different impacts on their educational benefits and eligibility to reenlist in military service after discharge. The report recommended that the Pentagon review its exemption process to try to increase its efficiency during periods of high volume requests and create a better policy to standardize reentry codes. It also noted that both recommendations were accepted by the Defense Department, which has already begun making changes. Next comes an article from military.com, headlined, Air Force to Posthumously Award Distinguished Flying Cross to Crews in Mysterious 2010 Osprey Crash. This was published by military.com, Thomas Novelli, March 15, 2024. Nearly 14 years after an Air Force Osprey crashed near Qalat, Afghanistan, due to a mechanical issue, two airmen who died in the accident will be honored by the service. Major Randall Voas and Senior Master Sergeant James Lackey will posthumously be awarded the Distinguished Service Cross. Air Force Operations Command announced this last week. Investigators said an unknown mechanical malfunction occurred, causing an emergency landing. Voas and Lackey's actions on April 19, 2010, saved the lives of two other crew members and 14 passengers on the Osprey. The service said, in addition to Voas and Lackey, an Army Ranger and a civilian contractor also died as a result of the crash. The news of the awards came as the service currently grapples with the deadly CV-22 crash that killed eight airmen off the coast of Japan late last year, and as the service struggles to find mechanical fixes for the Ospreys. Madeleine Voas, who was 16 when her father died and is now 30, said her family is grateful for the honor, even though it involves painful memories. She recalled being woken up when she heard her mother cry as news of her father's death was delivered by military personnel. I think it's going to feel really wonderful and just really fulfilling for our family for my dad to receive that, Madeline Vos said in a phone interview. In the years since, I've heard so many stories from people that he flew with and about how much of an amazing pilot he was. Secretary of the Air Force Frank Kendall gave retroactive authority to the AFSOC commander, Lieutenant General Tom Bauenfeld, to approve the award nominations, the service said in a press release last week. Randy and JB's actions in the face of chaos is what all air commandos train for, Bauenfeld said in a statement, referencing Voas and Lackey's nicknames. I'm grateful that we were able to recognize their final acts. The announcement came of the posthumous distribution of Flying Crosses awards to the two airmen 2 days before the Air Force announced plans to start pulling the CV-22 fleet back in the air following a 3-month stand down of the aircraft shortly following a deadly crash in this past November. Rebecca Haza, an AFSOC spokesman, told Military.com that the awards for Voas and Lackey were in the work prior to the November crash and that Bauenfeld received the authorization from Kendall in January to review the new award package. Voas and Lackey's aircraft took off as the lead aircraft in a 3-ship formation from a forward operating base on a 14-minute route to a landing zone near Kulat, according to an accident investigation report. After hitting unexpected tailwinds, the crew changed its flight plan and ended up crashing roughly a quarter of a mile from the intended landing area. The Osprey rolled on its landing gear across the sand, leaving marks indicative of a nearly perfect roll on landing. The accident report detailed the CV-22's nose gear collapsed and the nose section hit a ditch, causing the aircraft to flip tail over nose. Additionally, the left wing broke off and caught fire. The right wing and tail section also separated from the fuselage, investigators detailed in their report. The Accident Investigation Board president could not determine the cause of the crash, citing a lack of clear and convincing evidence, because the flight incident recorder, the vibration structural life, and engine diagnostics control unit, and the right engine were destroyed and could not be examined. An Air Force news release detailed this in 2010. At the time, the Taliban claimed its forces had shot the Osprey down, but the Air Force ruled out loss due to enemy action, environmental brownout conditions, and vortex ring state, the service said. Hensi said new information came to light, prompting the awards of the medals. We received additional information last year that allowed us to pursue those decorations, Hensi told Military.com. It doesn't change the conclusion of the Accident Investigation Board at all, but shed light on the actions of Major Voas and Sergeant Lackey during the mishap. The most recent crash off the coast of Japan on November 29 killed all 8 crew members aboard and triggered a grounding of all Air Force, Marine Corps, and Navy V-22 Ospreys. Military officials announced last week that the Ospreys would be returning to flight, even though the investigation into November's crash had not concluded. The investigation has revealed a new mechanical failure that is not fully understood, showcasing the second known persistent mechanical issue that is plaguing V-22s. The aircraft also has a year-long problem with its complex system of clutch assemblies that has caused at least 15 mishaps, some of which could have been fatal. Since the Osprey entered operations, this has been a persistent problem. The problem was revealed when the Air Force briefly grounded its fleet of Ospreys in the summer of 2022. The Air Force Special Operations Osprey that went down November 29, call sign Gundam 22, was on a training mission off Japan's Yukoshima Island. The recent news of the November Osprey crash that left 8 airmen dead was tough for Madeline Voas. She remembers what it was like losing her dad, and she doesn't want anyone else to experience that kind of pain. Even though it's been so long, it still feels like yesterday, she told Military.com. Anytime I see anything with, honestly, aircraft in general, the Osprey included, it is triggering. And I know what the families are going through, and I wish they didn't have to feel the way my family felt. Next from Military.com, U.S. military operations across the Sahel are at risk after Niger ends cooperation. Associated Press, Jessica Donati and Sam Mednick, published March 17, 2024. Dakar, Senegal is the dateline. The United States scrambled on Sunday to assess the future of its counterterrorism operation in the Sahel after Niger's junta said it was ending its years-long military cooperation with Washington following a visit by top U.S. officials. The U.S. military has hundreds of troops stationed at a major air base in northern Niger that deploys flights over the vast Sahel region south of the Sahara Desert, where jihadi groups like Al-Qaeda and the Islamic State operate. Top U.S. envoy Molly Fee returned to the capital, Niamey, this week to meet with senior government officials, accompanied by Marine General Michael Langley, head of the U.S. Military African Command. She had previously visited this in December, while acting Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland traveled to the country in August. The State Department said Sunday in a post on X, formerly Twitter, that talks were frank and that it was in touch with the junta. It wasn't clear whether the U.S. has any leeway left to negotiate a deal to stay in the country. Niger has been seen as one of the last nations in the rest of region that Western nations could partner with to beat back growing jihadi insurgencies. The U.S. and France had more than 2,500 military personnel in the region until recently, and together with other European countries had invested hundreds of millions of dollars in military assistance and training. But that changed in July when mutinous soldiers ousted the country's democratically elected president and months later asked French forces to leave. The U.S. military still had some 650 personnel working in Niger in December, according to a White House report to Congress. The Niger base is used for both manned and unmanned surveillance operations. In the Sahel, the U.S. also supports ground troops, including accompanying them on missions. However, such accompanied missions have been scaled back since U.S. troops were killed in a joint operation in Niger in 2017. It is unclear what prompted the hunters' decision to suspend military ties. On Saturday, the hunter spokesman, Colonel Major Amandu Abdramani, said U.S. flights over Niger's territory in recent weeks were illegal. Meanwhile, Insa Garba Saidu, a local activist who insists Niger's military rulers, with their communications, criticized U.S. efforts to force the junta to pick between strategic partners. The American bases and civilian personnel cannot stay on Nigerian soil any longer, he told the Associated Press. After her trip in December, Fee, the top U.S. envoy, told reporters she had good discussions with junta leaders and called on them to set a timeline for elections in return for restoring military aid ties. But she also said the U.S. had warned Niamey against forging closer ties with Russia. Neighboring Mali and Burkina Faso, which have experienced two coups since early 2020, have turned to Moscow for security support. After the coup in Niger, the military also turned to the Russian mercenary group Wagner for help. Cameron Hudson, who served with the Central Intelligence Agency and State Department in Africa, said the incident shows the diminution of U.S. leverage in the region and that Niger was angered by Washington's attempt to pressure the junta to steer clear of Russia. This is ironic, since once mantra of the Biden administration has been that Africans are free to choose their partners, he said. The U.S. delegation visit coincided with the start of Ramadan, a month of dawn-to-dusk fasting and intense prayer for Muslims. Niger's junta leader, General Abdulhashimani Tshishiani, refused to meet them. A U.S. press conference at the embassy in Niger was canceled. The junta spokesman, speaking on state television, said junta leaders met the U.S. delegation only out of courtesy and described their tone as condescending. Annalise Bernard, a former U.S. State Department official who specialized in African affairs and director of Strategic Stabilization Advisors, a risk advisory group, said the recent visit had failed and the U.S. needs to take a critical look at how it's doing diplomatically, not just in Niger, but in the whole region. What's going on in Niger and the Sahel cannot be looked at continuously in a vacuum, as we always do, she said. The United States government tends to operate with blinders on. We can't deny that our deteriorating relationships in other parts of the world, the Gulf, Israel, and others, all have an influential impact on our bilateral relations in countries in West Africa. Next, an interesting article from military.com. Headline: A suspected attack by Yemen's Houthi rebels has targeted a ship in the Gulf of Aden. Associated Press, John Gambrill, published March 17, 2024. Dubai, United Arab Emirates is the dateline. A suspected attack by Yemen's Houthi rebels saw an explosive detonate near a ship early Sunday in the Gulf of Aden, potentially marking their latest assault on shipping through the crucial waterways leading to the Red Sea. The British military's United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center said the vessel's crew saw the blast as it passed off the coast of Aden, the port city in southern Yemen, home to the country's exiled government. No damage to the vessel has been reported, and the crew are reported safe, Yukmoto said. The Houthis have launched repeated drone and missile attacks in the same area, disrupting energy and cargo shipment through the Gulf of Aden. The rebels did not immediately claim responsibility for the attack, though it typically takes the Houthis several hours before acknowledging their assaults. Separately, the U.S. Military Central Command said it carried out a series of strikes targeting the Houthis. It said it destroyed 5 drone boats and 1 drone before takeoff from Houthi-controlled territory in Yemen on Saturday. It was an unusually high number of drone boats to be destroyed. Separately, the U.S. military shot down 1 Houthi drone over the Red Sea, while another was presumed to have crashed. There were no reports of damage or injuries from ships in the vicinity, Central Command said. The Houthis have attacked ships since November, saying they want to force Israel to end its offensive in the Gaza Strip against Hamas. The ships targeted by the Houthis, however, largely have had little or no connection to Israel, the U.S. or other nations involved in the war. The rebels have also fired missiles toward Israel, though they have largely fallen short or been intercepted. The assaults on shipping have raised the profile of the Houthis, who are members of Islam's minority Shiite Zaydi sect, which ruled Yemen for 1,000 years until 1962. A report Thursday claimed the Houthis now have a hypersonic missile, potentially increasing that cachet and putting more pressure on Israel after a ceasefire deal failed to take hold in Gaza before the Muslim holiday month of Ramadan. Hypersonic missiles would pose a more serious threat to American and allied warships in the region. Earlier in March, a Houthi missile struck a commercial ship in the Gulf of Aden, killing 3 of its crew members and forcing survivors to abandon the vessel. It marked the first fatal attack by the Houthis on shipping. Other recent Houthi actions include an attack last month on a cargo ship carrying fertilizer that later sank after drifting for several days. Another article from military.com, Marine Corps continues path to retirement for artillery system that has seen heavy use in Ukraine. Military.com, Drew F. Lawrence, published March 15, 2024. For more than 2 decades, the High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, or HIMARS, has served as a key piece for U.S. deterrence, including in Europe. The launchers, built on the back of trucks and designed to send missiles or rockets over 150 miles to hit targets the size of a trash can using GPS, have also recently seen ample action in Ukraine as forces have worked to repel the Russian invasion. But the Marine Corps plans to retire the HIMARS over the next several years, instead prioritizing other platforms to pick up the capability a mobile rocket or missile launcher would offer, and heading full tilt toward its coastal mission. At the moment, however, there's still a key part of the U.S. arsenal as put on display during the Nordic Response 24 NATO exercise that included Marines earlier this month in Alta, Norway. If Putin decides to get ballsy and go off and do worse things than he's doing right now, one sergeant, a HIMARS maintainer, told Military.com during the exercise, "I'm going to be back out here fixing these things for us and for other countries, helping them out." The system has been a boon on the battlefield for Ukraine. The U.S. sent 39 of its rocket missile launchers to the country, and according to media reports, Russia hasn't destroyed a single one as of earlier this year, a testament to the mobility of the system. "They're all the hotness in the news right now," said First Lieutenant Morgan Long, the platoon commander for the HIMARS detachment in Norway, told this to Military.com. "What's great about them is their mobility and that their distance that they can shoot. You've got a system that can shoot further than the enemy can run away and faster. And then it's a system that can run away faster than the enemy can shoot back at them." Long said he was learning from the global events and applying those lessons learned from other militias, including that we can create a product that's been battle-tested, maybe by us, maybe by someone else. Yet, in accordance with the service's modernization plan, which in part wraps missile capabilities around the littoral units, the Corps is now looking at the Middle Launch Rocket System, MLRS, with a similarly advertised range to HIMARS, depending on the munition. The MLRS is tracked instead of wheeled, however, and has been battle-tested since the 80s. The Corps has had HIMARS since the early 2000s. The service will also use the Navy Marine Corps Expeditionary Ship Interdiction System, or NEMESIS, which it pronounced and procured last year. That system is mounted on a joint light tactical vehicle, is designed specifically for killing ships from land, and has a shorter range of about 60 miles, shorter than the HIMARS. The Marines in Norway told Military.com that HIMARS can also hit ships from land, but the NEMESIS employs the Naval Strike Missile, which is specifically designed for over-the-horizon ship destroying and fits nicely into the service's littoral aspirations. The priority is the anti-ship missile, and the HIMARS in the active component must be divested, Major Eric Flanagan, a spokesman for the Corps modernization efforts, told Military.com on Monday. He said there is not a specific date associated with retiring the system and that it is dependent on fielding other units, acquisition of systems, and any supply chain issues that may pop up. Marine Corps Times first reported the 5th Battalion, 11th Marines, a rocket and missile unit, will deactivate this month. The modernization effort has also changed Marine artillery overall, with the deactivation of 1st Battalion, 12th Marines last year, an artillery unit that tested the NEMESIS system early in the Corps' adoption of it. Now the active duty component of the Marine Corps will have 2 battalions with HIMARS. The reserves will have 1 battalion, according to Flanagan. While the retirement of the system is bittersweet to the Marines on the ground, its importance was still recognized. The location of the HIMARS system itself is not the important part. It's the ability to maneuver and position at a time and place of our choosing, Flanagan said. Here comes the next Military.com article. Navy fires commander of USS Ohio. Third submarine skipper relieved in 7 months. Published Military.com, Constantinian Turopin, March 14, 2024. The Navy fired the commander of one of its guided missile submarines on Monday, the third submarine firing in the last 7 months, according to a press release on Wednesday. The commanding officer of the USS Ohio, Subs Gold Crew, Captain Kurt Balanga, was relieved by Rear Admiral Nicholas Tillebrook, the commander of U.S. Submarine Group 9, due to a loss of confidence in his ability to command, the Navy said. Balanga appears to be the third Navy commander relieved this year. However, since last September, Navy leaders have fired the skippers of the USS Georgia, USS Alabama as well. Navy officials have previously said that in 2023, the service relieved 15 commanding officers. The Navy statement did not offer any more information about why Balanga was removed from leadership outside of the boilerplate loss of confidence remark. A Navy official told Military.com that the relief was related to conduct rather than performance, but would not offer any additional details. The Ohio is homeported in Bangor, Washington. According to Balanga's official biography, he enlisted in the Navy in 1992 as a nuclear electronics technician before earning his commission in 1997 through an ROTC program. Throughout his career, Balanga sailed on the ballistic missile submarine USS Kentucky, where he completed 5 strategic deterrent patrols, as well as the attack submarine USS Annapolis. He served as the executive officer on the USS Virginia, and he commanded the USS Annapolis before coming to the USS Ohio. The public biography does not say when Balanga took command of the Ohio's Gold Crew, but publicly released images put the date before January 2021. The Ohio is one of 4 guided missile submarines that were converted from carrying Trident II D5 nuclear ballistic missiles to Tomahawk land attack missiles. However, like their ballistic brethren, guided missile submarines have 2 sets of crews, blue and gold. They take turns managing the submarine and taking them on patrol. According to the Navy, this maximizes the submarine's strategic availability, reduces the number of submarines required to meet strategic requirements, and allows for proper crew training, readiness, and morale. Balanga's biography says that among his awards are the Defense Meritorious Service Medal, the Meritorious Service Medal, and the Navy and Marine Corps Commendation Medals. The Navy said that the Ohio's prospective commanding officer, Captain Andrew Kane, has assumed commander duties already. Next comes an article titled, Netanyahu Snaps Back at Growing U.S. Criticism After Being Accused of Losing His Way on Gaza. Associated Press, Tia Goldenberg and Ravi Nussbaum, published March 17, 2024. Dateline Tel Aviv, Israel. Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu railed Sunday, against growing criticism from top ally the United States against his leadership amid the devastating war with Hamas, describing calls for a new election as wholly inappropriate. In recent days, U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, the highest-ranking Jewish official in the country and a strong Israel supporter, called on Israel to hold a new election, saying Netanyahu had lost his way. President Joe Biden expressed support for Schumer's good speech and earlier accused Netanyahu of hurting Israel because of the huge civilian death toll in Gaza. Netanyahu told Fox News that Israel never would have called for a new U.S. election after the September 11th attacks in 2001 and denounced Schumer's comments as inappropriate. "We're not a banana republic," he said. "The people of Israel will choose when they will have elections and who they will elect, and it's not something that will be foisted on us." When asked by CNN whether he would commit to a new election after the war ends, Netanyahu said, "I think that's something for the Israeli public to decide." The U.S., which has provided key military and diplomatic support to Israel, also has expressed concerns about a planned Israeli assault on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where about 1.4 million displaced Palestinians are sheltering. The spokesman for the National Security Council, John Kirby, told Fox the U.S. still hasn't seen an Israeli plan for Rafah. The U.S. supports a new round of talks aimed at securing ceasefire in exchange for the return of Israeli hostages taken in Hamas October 6th and 7th. The Israeli delegation to those talks was expected to leave for Qatar after Sunday evening meetings of the Security Cabinet and War Cabinet, which will give direction for negotiations. Despite the talks, Netanyahu made it clear he would not back down from the fighting that has killed more than 31,000 Palestinians, according to local, that is Hamas, officials. More than 5 months have passed since Hamas attacked on southern Israel, killing 1,200 people, and another 250 were taken hostage. Early Saturday, Netanyahu said that calls for an election now, which polls show he would lose badly, would force Israel to stop fighting and paralyze the country for 6 months. Netanyahu also reiterated his determination to attack Hamas in Rafah and said that his government approved military plans for such an operation. "We will operate in Rafah. This will take several weeks, and it will happen," he said. "The operation is supposed to include the evacuation of hundreds of thousands of civilians, but it is not clear how Israel will do that." Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi reiterated his warnings that an Israeli ground offensive in Rafah would give grave repercussions on the whole region. Egypt says pushing Palestinians into the Sinai Peninsula would jeopardize its peace treaty with Israel, a cornerstone of regional stability. "We are also very concerned about the risks of a full-scale offensive in Rafah that would have on this vulnerable civilian population. This needs to be avoided at all costs." European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said this after a meeting with el-Sisi. And German Chancellor Olaf Scholz after meeting with Netanyahu on Sunday, warned that the most desperate the situation in Gaza becomes, the more this begs the question, no matter how important the goal, can it justify such terribly high costs? Or are there other ways to achieve your goal? Germany is one of Israel's closest allies in Europe, and given memories of the Holocaust, often treads carefully when criticizing Israel. After Alon Pincus, a former Israeli consul general in New York and an outspoken critic of Netanyahu, said the prime minister's comments fit with his efforts to find someone else to blame if Israel does not achieve its goal of destroying Hamas. He's looking on purpose for a conflict with the U.S. so that he can blame Biden, Pincus said. Both sides have something to gain politically from the dispute. The Biden administration is under increasing pressure from progressive Democrats and some Arab American supporters to restrain Israelis' war against Hamas. Netanyahu, meanwhile, wants to show his nationalist base that he can withstand global pressure, even from Israel's closest ally. But pressure also becomes from home, with thousands protesting again in Tel Aviv on Saturday night against Netanyahu's government and calling for a new election and a deal for the release of hostages. Large parts of the Israeli public want a deal, fearing that hostages are held in poor conditions and time is running out to bring them home alive. Israel's offensive has driven most of Gaza's 2.3 million people from their home. A quarter of Gaza's population is starving, according to the UN. Airdrops by the U.S. and other nations continue, while deliveries on a new sea route have begun. But aid groups say more ground routes and fewer Israeli restrictions on them are needed to meet humanitarian needs in any significant way. Of course, we should bring in humanitarian aid by road. Of course, by now we should be having at least two, three other entry points into Gaza, Chief Jose Andreas with World Central Kitchen, which organized the tons of food deliveries by sea, told NBC. The Gaza Health Ministry said at least 31,645 Palestinians have been killed in the war, according to Hamas. The ministry doesn't differentiate between civilians and combatants in its count, but says women and children make up two-thirds of the dead. Israel says Hamas is responsible for civilian deaths because it operates only in dense residential areas. The health ministry on Sunday said that the bodies of 92 people killed in Israel bombardment had been brought to hospitals in Gaza in the past 24 hours. Hospitals also received 130 wounded, it said. At least 11 people killed from Tabat family, including 5 children and 1 woman, were killed in an airstrike in Dar al-Balah city in central Gaza, according to the Palestinian Red Crescent Society and an Associated Press journalist. The body of an infant lay among the dead. Also from military.com, Russia says Ukrainian shelling killed 2 in a border city while it thwarted an incursion. Associated Press, L.C. Martin, published March 16, Ukrainian shelling of the Russian city of Belgorod killed 2 people, officials said Sunday, while Russia claimed to have thwarted a new attempt by saboteurs to cross the border. Saturday's attack occurred as Russians entered the second day of voting in a presidential election that is all but certain to extend Vladimir Putin's rule by another 6 years after he crushed any dissent. A man and woman died in the attack and three other people were wounded, Regional Governor Vyacheslav Gladkinov said on a telegram message. It was the latest in exchange of long-range missiles and rocket fire in Russia's war on Ukraine. Five people were also wounded when a Ukrainian drone hit a car in the village of Glotovo, some 2 kilometers, 125 miles, from the Ukrainian border. Russia's defense minister also said Saturday that it had thwarted attempts by Ukrainian sabotage and reconnaissance groups to enter the country from Ukrainian Sumy region. That followed an armed incursion claimed by Ukraine-based Russian opponents of the Kremlin on Tuesday in the Belgorod and Kursk regions. Russia's defense ministry said that Moscow's military and security forces killed 30 fighters while thwarting the latest incursion. The Russian Volunteer Corps, one of the groups who claimed to have crossed the border on Tuesday, who say they are fighting for the freedom of the Ukrainian and Russian people, released a video on social media Saturday claiming to have captured 25 Russian soldiers. Another of the group, the Freedom of Russia Legion, warned of a massive strike on military bases in Belgorod late afternoon Saturday and urged residents to take shelter. Shortly afterward, Russia's Ministry of Defense claimed that Russian air defenses had shot down 15 rockets over the Belgorod region. Videos appeared on local news suites and sites, appearing to show smoke rising from buildings and falling shrapnel. The authenticity of the videos couldn't be independently verified. Cross-border attacks in the area have taken place sporadically since the war began and have been the subject of claims and counterclaims, as well as disinformation and propaganda. Well, gang, that's going to be it for this edition of Military News. Again, this is Bob Mallon. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk again next time. Be kind to each other.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.